Skip the waiting room. TireRack.com offers convenient mobile tire installation in many areas. Simply shop TireRack.com for your next set of tires, and at checkout, choose Tire Rack Mobile Tire Installation. An expertly trained technician will arrive with your tires and install them on site, at home, at the office, wherever you are. You'll spend less time waiting and more time doing the things you enjoy. Learn more at TireRack.com.
At Delta, we know Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. On the next flight, 8C is Mandy, a foodie. So we offer all types of food options. Because at Delta, everyone flies their own way. Delta, keep climbing.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point. Former New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman had cast himself as a public champion of women, until he resigned this week in the wake of allegations that he hit, slapped, strangulated, and psychologically abused the women he dated. In the New Yorker magazine's report on the accusations, one woman said she dated Schneiderman and endured his abuse for a year. In turn, those revelations prompted Washington Post columnist Megan McArdle to write this week about how she, too, stayed with a man who hit her. This hour, On Point, it's complicated, it's personal, individual. Why return to an abuser? You can join us on air or online. What was your reaction to revelations about Eric Schneiderman? Could this be your story, too? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Jane Mayer. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and she and Ronan Farrow broke the story of the allegations against Eric Schneiderman. You can find a link to their report at our website, onpointradio.org. Jane, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. Great to be with you.
Well, if you're going to go after one of the more powerful elected officials in the country, you have to feel you've got your story totally squared away, a lead pipe cinch. How did you get it, and how did you check it?
Well, I totally agree. If you're going to take on something like this, you better be right, and it better be convincing. And so we worked very hard to make sure that it was completely ironclad. The story came to us in the form of the first woman. She came to The New Yorker because she had a friend there, and I was asked to look into it and talk to her. And when I did, I felt we... You know, in order to do a story like this, you need to have at least three women to really feel that it's sound and that it's a real pattern. So the amazing thing was it took very little time to find two additional women and then a fourth woman. And since the story has run, a couple more have reached out to us who have had similarly harrowing experiences with Eric Schneiderman. So it took, it took just patience and time and talking to people and then getting things like their medical records and photographs. One woman's got a photograph of her face after it was hit. The thing that jumped out at me was talking to each of these women, it became so predictably clear that there was a pattern. I mean, the same, they'd never spoken to each other for the most part until we were doing the story, and each one of them described this same thing, the same lines, the same the actions. It became kind of incontrovertible.
One of the things that happens often in a case like this is that the person who's the subject of the report goes to ground. Could you get much out of Schneiderman or his representatives?
No. He put out a statement through he hired a sort of crisis PR firm that sent us a statement, and he has an outside lawyer. And at first we heard that he was saying he was innocent and he was baffled, and then we sent them the specific questions, and I think he resigned in 2 hours and 57 minutes after the story went online.
For people who haven't read it, and without getting too lurid, maybe you could give us a description of what these women said, the Attorney General, and at the time of these instances, he was the Attorney General of New York State, what he did to them.
Yeah, they were quite frightened of him because he was the Attorney General of New York State with so much authority over the legal system in the state that they were afraid that something terrible would happen if they tried to speak out against him. And he had said that to a couple of them that he would kill them if they left him or publicized these allegations. He said to one that he'd have her followed. He could have her followed, or he could have her phones tapped. I think he did have authority in the state to do that to people. And so what they said was that when they became romantically involved with him, or even had a romantic encounter in the case of one person where he was simply making a move on someone, that out of the blue, he hit them very hard across the face with his open hands and slapped them. And that when they stayed involved with him, it became a sort of something that he did while having sex with them. He'd hit them, he'd strangle them, spit at them, and call them names that I'm not going to use demeaning language. I'm not going to use on the airwaves here, but you can read the piece. And that they would tell him to stop. They didn't like it. They were not. This was not S&M. This was not some sort of sex game gone wrong. In a couple occasions, he hit people when they were just fully clothed, not involved with him in any kind of sexual way, just out of the blue. And they were stunned, shocked, horrified. But in some cases, as you said in your promo to the show, they went back to him in some cases.
And in these particular cases, these were not women who were married to Eric Schneiderman, not sharing living quarters, sharing assets, not raising children together. Who might also arguably be in jeopardy. Many of the conventionally heard reasons why women return were not present in these cases, and yet they did. What did they say about why that happened?
You know, I think that they felt he was a kind of a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde character, and the good side of him was, I think they were in love with him. He's a very prominent and intelligent and charismatic figure and very charming. And they were women in their 40s. In some cases, I think in several of these cases, he said he wanted to marry them. They would have loved to have gotten married at that point in their life. And they were. He didn't do this on the first date for the most part. There's one person who he did hit right when he was just, you know, in the very beginning, trying to get her to get involved with him, and she was the one that walked away on the spot. But the others, they were pretty involved with him by the time he started this. One said it was like he was testing her, and he'd started sort of lightly, you know, slapping her, and then it became this thing where she said we couldn't have sex without him beating me. They got out. They all got out, and they actually, the average length of an abusive relationship, according to one of the experts I spoke to, a forensics sociologist named Evan Stark, who's quite an expert on this area, said the average length is 5.5 years for an abusive relationship. So he said to me, these women got out relatively fast. They were all about a year, give or take a little. Still, I mean, you know, these women were deeply ashamed. They didn't want to report it. They also were very frightened of him, and it was very hard to get them to go on the record. But two of them finally did. They did because they were afraid this would happen to other women, and they really wanted to stop him from doing this to anyone else, and they wished someone had warned them.
Jane Mayer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. You can find a link to a report at our website, her report with Ronan Farrow, on our website, onpointradio.org. Jane, great to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ray.
Joining me now from Washington is Megan McArdle. She's an opinion columnist for The Washington Post, and her most recent column is headlined, "I Went Back to a Man Who Hit Me. I'm still thinking about why." You can find a link to the piece at our website as well. Megan, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
When you heard the Schneiderman story, did you start to think about your life?
I did. You know, my editor, who is a woman, emailed out to some of the other women and said, you know, are we going to weigh in on this? How are we going to weigh in on this? And I had my print column coming up. And so I went back and read the piece. I had been traveling when it broke, so I'd only seen the headlines. I hadn't actually read it. And as I was reading through it, thinking, is this something I'm going to write about? I suddenly came to the passage where they talk about, you know, returning to him and this Jekyll and Hyde feeling. And I thought about, well, that was, you know, I remember that. I remember the night I decided to go back, and I was a little worried about writing about it. It's not something I've ever written about in public before.
What clinched the decision for you? What, you know, at one point you're thinking, this is something, a private part of my history.
Yes.
Only one other person knows about it, arguably.
But a then few, but not many.
Right. But then there's a moment where you say, okay, I can tell a lot of people about this, people who don't know me.
Yes. Well, you know, I was really, I had this real reluctance to do it. And I emailed my editors and said, look, I'm thinking about this, but I'm not sure. I'm kind of worried about writing this. And we talked about it a bit. And I thought, you know, the fact that I am so reluctant, why am I so reluctant to do this? Why am I so ashamed of it? Or why do I feel that somehow if I tell people about this, it will like spoil my image in some way, right? That this thing that happened to me 25 years ago. And I thought that's absurd, right? I don't have anything to be ashamed of. It wasn't the best decision I've ever made, but I made a lot of bad decisions at that age. and I have written about many of them. So why am I so ashamed to write about this one? And that was the point at which I said, I think I kind of have to, because I think that that stigma and that shame, and also I thought I have something to say about this that no one else has said, and it tied into some of the other things that I had been thinking about the Me Too movement. And so I wrote back and said, okay, I'm going to do this. And I was actually at a panel, so I had to sit in the green room and write this column. But I did. It was hard. It was much harder than I had expected.
Did you have to go through a bunch of versions before you could find the right words to describe what happened to you?
No, it was actually the moment that I decided to do it, the first line of the column was in my head. I already knew because it was this sound that was in my voice when I called my roommate and said, he hit me. And I knew that I was going to start with that because 25 years later, I can still hear exactly what I sounded like and the way my voice broke and how sort of childish and afraid I sounded. And so that's where I started, and then it actually, the rest of it came out pretty quickly.
We've been talking about domestic abuse in the wake of the allegations against former New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. Washington Post columnist Megan McArdle has shared the story of her experience in an abusive relationship, and we want to hear from you. Do you know firsthand how hard it is to walk away? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes life is exactly like the movies.
T-minus 30 seconds.
They said T-minus. They said T-minus.
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy and sometimes about rocket ships.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. The allegations of domestic abuse against former New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman have opened up a conversation about the complexities surrounding domestic violence. You can join the conversation. Have you experienced such abuse? Is this a secret you've never told? You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest is Megan McArdle. She's an opinion columnist for The Washington Post, and her most recent column is headlined,
I went back to a man who hit me. I'm still thinking about why. You can find a link to the piece at our website, onpointradio.org. Well, for those who haven't read it, what did you conclude about why you went back?
Well, in my case, I should be clear that the incident was ambiguous. It occurred in the context of a relationship with a man who had severe anger problems, and, you know, in part because of his own childhood. And so I spent my whole life during that relationship just waiting for the next time he was going to get really angry at me. Often over small things. The first time it happened, he literally went and flew into a rage because I had dropped my coat on the floor of his bedroom. And I was so stunned by this that that was probably a bad sign. And so we were having a fight. He was gesturing near my head and his connected with my face. And I never knew whether it was deliberate or not. And that was part of it. And it was also, but it was also that, you know, it's very easy when you're hearing these stories, like, why would you go back? This terrible person. And as I said in the column, you know, you're picturing an archetype. You're picturing an abuser, right? I'm picturing the man who was in many ways wonderful and who was funny and brilliant and often made me very happy. And that is the reckoning that I think that we have trouble with.
Well, there's an internal and an external narrative, isn't there?
I mean, yes.
You were in the couple with this guy. From outside, I'm sitting and listening to you thinking, I've heard a lot of stories like this where someone is described as loving and brilliant and accomplished and wonderful and good company, except, and then there's this pivot moment in the story where you hear totally unreasonable demands, efforts at control, rages flying off the handle, and you think, well, gee, that would be it for me. But it isn't.
It isn't, in part because by the time it gets there, right, you're already kind of in it. I was very young. I wouldn't make that decision now. But it's just extremely difficult when you're in it to say, well, that was it. That was too far. And I think it's probably easier if it comes as the culmination of if it's really strange, right? That nothing like this ever happened before and it's just out of the blue. But when it's kind of the culmination of a step process where you're investing more and more in this person who has a lot of problems with anger, you know, I was a good feminist. It wasn't that I didn't know that you're not supposed to stay with men who hate you. It's that I contextualized it and I said, well, maybe it wasn't deliberate. And to this day, I don't know that it was, honestly. I mean, but I think that should have been, actually, I think a lot of things before that should have been, I can't be treated like this. Whatever your other wonderful qualities, I can't stay here. But it should have been a cutoff line, and it wasn't because I was already so far in it and because I really loved him. It wasn't that, you know, it's easy on the Hallmark Channel where you can see this guy is kind of charming, but you know, right, in the Lifetime movie, you can just see it in his eyes. He's going to be – he wasn't like that at all. And that is, I think, why it is so hard to explain outside. I mean, you think about it. I think about it when I try to describe my current husband, who I love and who is not abusive. But when I try to describe why I love him, right, I'm stuck. You know, he's funny.
That's the alchemy of
it is,
the relationship,
right?
Between two people.
It's the specificity that you can't describe. It's the little things that you cannot communicate to other people. All of the little wonderfulnesses that add up to your love for someone. And that, I think, is very hard to communicate outside, which is why it always sounds so obvious. And I to be clear, you shouldn't stay with someone who hit you. But why it always sounds so easy when you are hearing someone else's story, and why, in fact, it is much harder, even when there's no economic dependency, even when you don't have kids, even when you're not living together, why it's much harder when you're in it than when you're listening from outside.
Galena, Maryland is our first stop this hour. Lizzie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Welcome.
I was in a 15-year marriage, and Megan and you have covered a lot of great points that are textbook classic. It's been going on for forever. And one of the things in the 1960s, when women began divorcing more, it's also bled into leading to tons of poverty for women who were able to get away. I myself had a charming, hardworking guy who was very funny, very polite, mannerly, considerate. Everyone who met him thought he was great. I thought he was great. I fell deeply in love with him, and 6 months into the 15-year, what ended up 15-year relationship, pushed me up against a wall in anger, which shocked me. I let that go. I excused it. I justified it. I rationalized it. When you're deeply in love with someone, you want to rationalize it. Years into the relationship, it escalated. It escalated from month to month. The pushes became bruises, black eyes. I was eventually hit with an open hand slap up against my head so hard that it busted 80% of my eardrum out. I had to have a 2.5-hour surgery from that, and I have a permanent hearing loss and severe tinnitus to this day.
Well, Lizzie, let me jump in there. When it got to that point, did you share these stories with anybody else? Did you have to tell a doctor honestly what happened?
When it got to that point in year 13, I put myself through college because that is one of the major factors. Once you've tied up with someone you love and you've had a child, you've had a home and bills, you don't just walk away with that child and say, oh, okay, I'm leaving. So you have to take time to get through it emotionally. Many women who were abused as children. They had low self-esteem. Many times the men that they are in love with, the dysfunctional two magnets that get together because he may have come from abuse. You don't see it right off the bat. By the time you're invested, committed financially, and with children tied up, you don't just walk away very easily. It's very emotional. It can fling you into poverty. It changes your children's lives. It's a mess.
Lizzie, thanks a lot for being willing to tell us your story. Thanks a lot for your call. Norwalk, Connecticut is next. Jan, welcome to the program. Hello, Jan.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My story is very similar to the last story, where I was married to a very successful man who was an abuser. He was mentally ill. He was highly abusive, and I couldn't leave because we had children together. We had a home together, and it was just not possible to leave. I went back to school. I received a graduate degree and was able to leave, and I left.
How long did it take, Jen?
Oh, when they say 5.5 years, that's pretty good. That's kind of in there. That's in the range. And finally, he committed suicide after I left, after we were divorced.
Wow. Did you find yourself, the two commonalities I hear in a lot of these stories is making excuses for the guy, which is one version of how you explain this to yourself, or blaming yourself, which I think is even a little bit more poisonous. Did you do either of those?
No, I made up stories thinking that it would get better. That's what I did. I deluded myself into believing that it would get better.
Jan, thanks a lot for your call. Megan McArdle, what do you say to Lizzie and Jan?
You know, I think that these are the stories that you hear over and over again. And once you're really committed, once you're in a marriage and there are kids, the whole equation changes because, yes, it is very hard to survive without a partner. To go and testify to your abuse in court is shaming, and you know you don't know that he'll be able to provide alimony. In many cases, he can't. It is very difficult, and it is absolutely true as you say. I mean, one of the sort of interesting things to me is that even years later, I still find I stop myself from writing in the column about the things that I did as a bad girlfriend. And, like, you know, I have my annoying habits, but none of them merit the kind of daily screaming that I was subjected to, and the worry that I had after I went back that it was going to escalate further. But it is very difficult to not blame yourself, in part because, look, I made a decision to go back, right? I mean, that I blame is the wrong word. Victims of domestic violence never deserve blame. But ultimately, they are the ones who have the responsibility to leave. It would be nice if the person who is blameworthy were also the person who is always able to fix a problem, but that isn't always true. And so you know when you went back that you did decide to stay, and that you decided to stay with him after the first time. And if you don't approach that carefully, very psychologically carefully, that translates into feeling, well, this is really my fault. It's not your fault. It's never your fault. The truth is, however, that you do have to decide to leave, and that means recognizing that it was a mistake to stay.
Joining me, let me jump in because I want to bring in Julie Owens. She joins me from Charlotte, North Carolina. She's a survivor of domestic abuse and a certified domestic violence counselor who's worked in the field of violence against women for more than 30 years. She's also served as an expert consultant on domestic violence for the U.S. Department of Justice. Julie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for having me on.
What did you hear in the stories that we've gotten from our callers so far?
Wow. I mean, every woman who has spoken has just been so poignant and so right on. They could do the training I do, actually, for professionals, because they're talking about classic domestic violence and coercive control. And the common themes are stunning. I think many times for people who aren't familiar with domestic violence, there are so many myths out there about why it happens and why victims stay and why abusers do what they do. And, you know, victims believe the same myths. And so being in the middle of that relationship where coercive control it just consumes you 24/7 and you are living under siege, it's very hard for anyone on the outside to understand what that's like, right? It's not this series of, you know, isolated incidents. It's living with someone who has complete power and control over you for a variety of reasons, who believes that they are completely entitled and superior, and that you must do what they say, and if you don't, you're threatened. And I do think that, at least for me, and I think for a lot of the women I've worked with over the years, that we did buy into the myths. You know, we thought that he was just under a lot of stress, that he had a real anger problem, that it was drugs or alcohol that was making him act this way, or that he was sick somehow and or mentally ill. And a lot of times I think, you know, they think, well, especially if they're married, you know, or religious, I married him in sickness and in health. Now I need to help him. And that's because, as we've heard, it doesn't always start right away. A lot of times it's not until they're married or living together, or she's pregnant, or they're otherwise, they're really bonded, they're a couple. And then once it starts, it's so confusing, as we've heard, and there are multiple reasons, I think, why victims stay.
Well, you know, the callers all talked about domestic situations where they were married and, of course, living together with their abuser. But some of the times that it's come to public notice so far this year, these are less tied relationships. In a 2015 interview with NBC's Dateline, one of the dozens of women who accused the entertainer Bill Cosby of sexual assault explained to her interviewer why she continued to associate with Cosby after he allegedly drugged and raped her.
A lot of people would probably be thinking, well, I'll just walk away. I'll just get out.
I was completely dominated, controlled, in complete and utter brainwash situation.
I think that's the part, Julie, that flummoxes people. When you are not living, when you don't share children, when you don't depend financially or emotionally on this person, and you go back anyway?
Well, there is traumatic bonding that takes place. Because abusers just basically take over your life, they cut off your sources of support, and it really is like brainwashing. It's Stockholm Syndrome, which you've probably heard about. We say abusers don't have relationships. They take hostages. And that's what it's like. And every time a victim tries to pull away or leave, then they're threatened. And the fear starts to build up. And then if they're injured, then that fear is just embedded. And he seems so omnipotent that there's no way to get away. And like in my case, he threatened to kill my father if I left, and he told me what he would do specifically, how he would injure him in a very graphic and horrific way. And, you know, I didn't believe him because he had never hit me. So much of this abuse is not physical. And a lot of abuse is sexual, and sexual violence is extremely powerful and terrifying. And so if you believe they're going to do something even worse after you leave, then leaving, you know, is terrifying. And we know that 75% of the time when a victim is murdered by her partner, it's after she's left or when she's leaving. So sometimes leaving is not even the safest thing to do. And, you know, so we don't want to be telling women just leave, because they need a safety plan and they need to, you know where to go, where they'll be safe and not be stalked and so forth and so on. But in my case, my abuser did follow through. This man had never hit me, but then he did.
We'll pick it up after a break. We're discussing the complexities that surround the issues of domestic violence. You can join the conversation. Are you a survivor? Did you stay with or go back to your abuser? Can you explain why? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're discussing the complexities that surround the issue of domestic violence. You can join the conversation. How should we change the way we think and talk about this issue? You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are Julie Owens, a domestic violence survivor and certified domestic violence counselor, and Megan McArdle, an opinion columnist for The Washington Post, who shared her own story in a recent column. You can find a link to the piece at our website, onpointradio.org. As New York Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman had sued Harvey Weinstein over the slew of sexual misconduct and assault allegations against the disgraced movie producer. Here's Schneiderman condemning Weinstein's alleged act at a February press conference.
We have investigated other companies for patterns of sexual discrimination or harassment. We have never seen anything as despicable as what we've seen here.
After domestic allegations from two of his ex-wives surfaced against the former White House staffer Rob Porter in February, President Trump seemed to defend Porter's character in a press conference.
He did a very good job when he was in the White House, and we hope he has a wonderful career, and hopefully he will have a great career ahead of him. But it was very sad when we heard about it, and certainly he's also very sad. Now, he also, as you probably know, he says he's innocent, and I think you have to remember that.
In the case of Eric Schneiderman, a man who reportedly went on the warpath against Harvey Weinstein once the allegations against the producer surfaced. In the case of Donald Trump, seeming almost to gloss over or excuse the charges against Rob Porter. From our website, one writes, "Bear in mind that the economic ability to leave an abusive relationship is relatively new for women, as are domestic violence laws. What our grandmothers were forced to live with was normal for most of history. Change takes time, but we're getting there. this show helps. Clarksville, Tennessee is our next stop. Denise, welcome to the program.
Hey, Ray. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say my situation's a little different, not much, but I was really young when I got with my ex-husband, and neither one of us came from abusive homes. As we first got together, after a year, within that first year, I learned really quick, you know, him chasing me, choking me, just he would tie me up to leave me at the house so I would have to be there while he would go off and do what he wanted to do. And as the kids got older, and 16 years, I was with him for 16 years, the kids finally, you know, what finally led me to leave him was he was getting closer and closer to choking me and going to kill me. And I had gone to a couple women's shelters, and in the counseling I learned, they told me that I allowed this circle of violence to go on, that basically it was kind of my fault, but not. But because I stayed in that circle of violence, I kept allowing it to go on. And I was really upset when they first told me that, but in a way it was right. I had to step out of that circle of violence to make a change. And it's not easy, but, you know, I eventually, my kids told me, look, Mom, he's going to kill you. You got to go. And that there's another light that went off for me. My kids are even making sense now. Come on, let's go. And I eventually did get out, got a job, and it was rough. I got on my feet, got my kids back and everything, but it was pure, it was awful. He was very, very abusive.
You know, Denise, cutting off your airway and cutting off your carotid artery is so common that in the language around this, there's actually a term for it, non-fatal manual strangulation. It is so common that we have a name for it, and it comes up again and again in women's stories of their abuse. Hands around the neck, people passing out, people unable to breathe. It is the most gross and aggressive form of physical domination, literally making it impossible for you to breathe. And frightening, frightening to hear about, to read about, to hear people talk about it. Denise, thanks a lot for your call.
All right, thank you.
Monroe, North Carolina is next. Teresa's with us. Teresa, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thank you for taking my call. My experience was like 30 plus years ago when I was 20 and 21. I was recovering from drug abuse and got involved with someone that was in the medical field and was part of my treatment process. So we had the classic powerful person and the weak person. And I remember it like it was yesterday. And I tried to talk to people about it and nobody believed it because in their minds, I had no credibility. You know, here I was, this person that had gotten into a little bit of drug abuse. And so the abuse started really early and it was physical, it was mental, it was sexual. Not even my family believed me at first, and I moved across the country back to my family. He would call in the middle of the night and say the most horrible things to me, and my parents never believed it, and I went back to him because everybody convinced me that he was the best I was ever going to get. And finally, after he almost killed me, I got out, and I went through a lot of counseling. I ended up living in my car, because he had taken everything from me. And it was years before I could look people in the face and feel like I had any value, because his MO was to isolate and make you feel like you were nothing and that no one wanted anything to do with you. You had nothing to add to this world. And the recovery took a long time. And if somebody's out there listening, I want to say, if you're in this, you think you can't survive it, getting out of it, but you can't survive staying in it. You've got to get out. You can do it. Talking about it, listen to your friend's advice. You know, it sounds like you don't want to take it, but they're right. And you're talking to them for a reason. You're talking to them because you need to hear something, and it's there if you're listening.
Teresa, thanks so much for your call. Megan McArdle, take what Teresa just said and keep in mind what our correspondent on our website said about the changes in human relations in recent years, that women have economic ability, that domestic violence laws are pretty new. Is your column, are these stories part of a recalibration of what we're willing to countenance as a society, what we're willing to root out and punish, what we're willing to talk about out loud.
I certainly hope so. And I certainly hope that more women, you know, I think it's wonderful how many women survive this and go on to become public speakers about domestic violence and domestic violence counselors and these other incredibly valuable roles. But I would also like to see more women like me who don't make this kind of the central part of their identity, but show people that, like, look, there is life after this. You don't have to stay. I know it's terrifying to leave. I know you worry that you'll never find anyone else. You worry about how you're going to support yourself if you're married and economically tied. There are people out there to help you, and you can go on, and you can go on and have this be a part of your past, but not the only part of your past. And that, I think, is something that's very hard to see when you're in it and you feel like, I love this person, and this is, I will never find someone who will be with me again if I leave them. It's really difficult.
That's a toxic message, and it comes from people who know us and like us.
And I think, too, we should say, and something that I regret just a little bit about the column, I have a friend who's a male survivor of domestic abuse, and who reached out to me after the column ran, and I had known about that before. And, you know, there are men in this situation, too. Now, they're less physically at risk just because of the size and strength differentials between men and women, but they are suffering and they are having exactly the same difficulty of ending a long-term relationship where there are children, where there are big repercussions, and also ending a relationship with someone they loved. Often it does involve alcohol or drugs. And that those men too need to hear, like, look, there's life after this. It's going to be really hard when you do it. And eventually you're going to be really glad you did.
Concord, North Carolina is next. Jay, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I was teed up pretty well right there. I was also in an abusive relationship. I was young when I got with my ex-wife, and I think that was one of the biggest problems is that, you know, you're young and you don't really understand what's going on in relationships. My issue was, you know, I thought that every time that she got upset, oh, it's okay. You know, she's going to change. I can change her because I'm not violent. I'm not a mean-spirited person. So, you know, she's going to change eventually. And I kept thinking that every time that we had a fight and, you know, and I always thought it was a fight when I didn't realize that I was being abused all throughout that time, thinking, you know, I believed that she was going to, you know, that I wasn't going to get anything better at that time, that I was going to just stay in the same situation. And for years, that went on. And then added to that was that she had children that had become my stepdaughters. And, you know, I felt I couldn't leave them because she was getting violent towards them. And then I felt like I couldn't leave because then they were going to be worse off.
What form did it take, Jay? What form did the abuse take?
Well, first of all, it was, you know, at the beginning, I thought, okay, she's jealous and she loves me so much that she's acting this way. You know, it was just grabbing and holding. And then eventually it turned to, you know, sticking your nails in your arms and then grabbing you by the hair. And you keep thinking, oh, she's just jealous. When I go out, she just gets jealous, you know, because she loves me so much. And this is probably normal. When I never saw that in my life before, you know, I grew up in a religious home, so I didn't see that kind of jealousy, violence behavior. And eventually it turned into, you know, at the worst time, I remember one time just sitting down on a couch and all of a sudden passing out, waking up with, you know, tasting metal in my mouth and realizing that I just have been knocked out with a pot that she hit me on the head, you know, eventually turned also into trying to stop me and running the car over and putting a hole in the garage while the kids were playing in the other side of the TV. Only at the point where the police came over to the house and realized that I was the one that had scratches, because even when the police came, I wouldn't say that I had, I was in a fight with my wife. First of all, I was scared that if I said something, I will be the one going to jail, because that's most courts, you know, take the side of the woman, even to this day. And I was scared that if I ever said anything, I would be the one going to jail. But the police realized that I was the one who had scratches. She has no scratches. Finally, she went to jail. And only at that time, only that day, I realized, okay, this is my opportunity. I got to get out of here.
Jay, let me turn to Julie Owens, who works with families where there is violence. Is this a familiar story to you, Julie?
It is familiar. I hear it a whole lot more from women than I do from men. But the dynamic is the same, and believing that it's a fight and the kids need me and thinking it's just about somebody who's jealous and so forth. I think that's very typical. And
but is it harder for men to admit they're actually being physically dominated by a woman?
I think it is, but I also think it's hard for women to admit it. I think it's hard for everybody, too. It's embarrassing, humiliating. We're not believed, blamed. And the abuser has convinced the victim so often that it's their fault. And so that what we were talking about, that sort of traumatic bonding, what happens is they're so focused on the abuser and just making it from day to day and surviving everything and making them happy walking on eggshells with him or her, that they trade escape skills for coping skills in a way. And every once in a while when the abuser does something nice and it's sweet, even though it might be manipulative kindness, it's the best that it is. And so there's a tendency to think this is the real him, this is the real her. And when that's the case, it makes it that pity for, you don't want that person, anything bad to happen to that person. And so it's a real, you know, it's a real tug. It's emotional, it's psychological, and it's biological. It's all of those things, because abuse changes a person.
Let me try to get one more caller on this hour from Waynesville, North Carolina. Jeffrey, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I wanted to offer a perspective. I am a past male abuser. I used to abuse my relationships, my wives, and I am no longer an abuser. But I wondered if there were any questions that I might be useful in answering, or a perspective that I might give that could be useful.
Well, we're toward the end of our time, Jeffrey, but I'm curious how you stopped and how you realized that this could not go on.
Well, it took a long, long time. What was interesting about my particular situation was that it was only when I felt I was in a safe relationship, that is, when I was married or in a long-standing relationship, that I felt secure enough to become physically abusive. And I'm not proud of that fact. I'm stating facts, not an opinion as to right or wrong. And what caused me to finally take notice of what my therapists were offering, and I went to several therapists over the years, but when I finally did it for me and not because of somebody else prevailing upon me to do it, was when it became successful, as recently as 5 years ago. I'm now 82, and I was abusive up until I was 70 years old.
Jeffrey, thanks so much for your call, and thanks so much for your honesty. And thank you, all of our callers, this hour. Megan McArdle is an opinion columnist for The Washington Post. Her most recent column is headlined, "I Went Back to a Man Who Hit Me. I'm Still Thinking About Why." You can find a link to the piece at our website, onpointradio.org. Megan, great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
Julie Owens is a domestic violence counselor and coordinator who's worked in the field of violence against women for more than 30 years. She's also served as an expert consultant on domestic violence for the U.S. Department of Justice. Julie, great to have you.
Thank you so much.
Well, join us all next week for On Point. Visit our On Point website, onpointradio.org. Get our podcast. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point. Thank you.